Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Today's economic four-letter word? Yeah, you got it. J-O-B-S. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Friday, the 4th of May. Good to have you with us. I think we can fairly say that the April unemployment report landed with a thud this morning. Just 115,000 new jobs. The unemployment rate is 8.1%, basically unchanged. It is, should you happen to be counting, the third month in a row of slowing job growth. We're going to get to the nitty-gritty of it all in just a second, but Marketplace's Amy Scott gets us going first with the big picture.
So there is a little good news. The economy added more jobs in February and March than the Labor Department initially thought.
Overall, you know, the recovery is still continuing, but at a more, you know, modest, almost a sluggish pace.
That's economist Jennifer Lee with BMO Financial Group. And then there's what looks like good news, but isn't. Unemployment fell to its lowest rate in 3 years, but only because so many more people gave up the job hunt. What's known as the labor participation rate is at a 30-year low. Harry Holzer was chief economist with the Labor Department under President Clinton. He teaches at Georgetown.
Sometimes those people find other productive things to do for a while. They're more likely to go to college and go to graduate school. People might stay home and decide they want to spend more time with their kids. But eventually, a lot of those folks will want to come back into the job market.
That'll mean even more pressure on the economy. Holzer says at this pace, it would take most of the decade to add enough jobs to really bring down unemployment. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
So this is one of those stories you obviously can't wrap up in just a minute. So we're going to take four more right now. Here for our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond, we've got Catherine Rampell of the New York Times. She's in our studios in New York City. Sadeep Reddy from the Wall Street Journal is down in Washington. Hey, guys.
Hey, Kai.
Hi.
Hey, so Catherine, let me ask you this, just to start on a positive note, if I might. The fact that the economy is strong enough now that 115,000 jobs is disappointing, isn't that a good thing, right? Because 6 months ago, we'd have been thinking this was great, 115.
Not really.
Oh,
Six months ago, 6 months ago, this is about where we were, actually. What's been disappointing is that for the last couple of years, and this year included, the year starts out with relatively strong growth, and then it kind of peters out. I mean, obviously, 115,000 jobs added is better than 115,000 jobs lost.
Yes.
But that's like saying, oh, it's better than a poke in the eye with a sharp stick.
Yeah, all right. So, Sudeep, give me some love here. Are you buying that or what?
Well, in some ways, yes.
All right.
You have to remember in January 2009, the worst month for the job market that we've seen in a long time, the economy lost 818,000 jobs in a single month. So we're far, far, far away from that kind of a disastrous performance. But we've settled into this new period of persistent mediocrity in a way, where we're barely treading water, and it seems to be continuing at this same pace,
yeah.
And it just doesn't leave much hope for people who are looking for work and on the sidelines.
Yeah, which gets us to this thing that Amy brought up in her spot, Catherine, the labor force participation rate. Explain to me in layman's terms why that is so significant in this report.
It's significant because typically when the economy is getting better, when it's adding jobs, people who had previously given up looking for work, who were sitting on the sidelines, say, hey, you know what, maybe there are opportunities for me, and they jump back into the labor force. We're actually seeing the opposite. People are dropping out. They're, for whatever reason, and it's very unclear why. I mean, some economists will tell you, well, this is part of a longer-term trend. People are aging. We have many baby boomers who are entering their retirement years. But it's not totally accounted for by that. You have a lot of younger workers who are dropping out, middle-aged workers who are dropping out. And if this isn't a fluke, we don't know, that could represent that, you know, more people are giving up.
Right. Okay, Sudeep, we have, if I'm counting right, five more of these monthly reports before Election Day. The American economy is an intractable beast, very tough to move. Is anything really going to change, do you think? Can it change?
It's very unlikely that anything's going to change for the better, and that's the problem. We're stuck in this very slow growth period right now, and the really troubling thing is we're having this kind of moderate, middling growth when conditions abroad are relatively calm. Europe hasn't blown up despite its many troubles. Iran hasn't become a crisis. Oil prices haven't shot up to $150 or $200 a barrel. Mm-hmm. All of the weakness we're seeing, the slow growth we're seeing in the U.S. is when things are abroad are okay. And we've seen in the last 2 years that things abroad can get not okay very, very quickly.
Yeah, in a big bad hurry. So, Catherine, I mean, is there anything that can happen in Washington that's going to turn this around? Forget the politics of this for a second, because if the politics were fine, it would have been fixed. But what could conceivably be done? Anything?
Well, I think the politics – you can't throw aside the politics.
Yeah,
it's
know,
like saying without the rain, it's dry out. So there's disagreement amongst economists about what would and would not work. I would say that kind of the mainstream view is that at the very least you want to avoid cutting more government jobs. You want to avoid cutting government spending, which has been happening.
Mm-hmm.
Even more so, probably what you'd want to do is some kind of stimulus package, whether it means more funds for the states that are laying off workers or some kind of massive jobs program. I mean, you can think about all sorts of different iterations of government intervention.
Yeah. Well,
unlikely.
Yeah, well, exactly. So on the political side, but Sudeep, very quickly, let me ask you about the Federal Reserve and quantitative easing and this idea that maybe there's something else the Fed can do. And when I say quickly, by the way, I mean quickly.
It's entirely possible that the Fed could respond to something like this. The more we get weak numbers, then the more the Fed will be inclined to at least talk about what it will do.
Yeah.
And just the talk about what the Fed will do might actually provide some support for the economy by pushing interest rates down even lower and providing at least some kind of a modest boost to the stock market. And that could be important going into the fall.
All right. We'll see what happens. Sudeep Reddy at the Wall Street Journal. He's in Washington. Catherine Rempel from the New York Times. She was at the New York Times, I'm told, not in our studios. Guys, have a good weekend.
Thanks, Guy.
You too.
All right, see you. So that was the big picture. It was the commentary on jobs. How about a translation of the actual Bureau of Labor Statistics report? How are you supposed to know what jobs are hot and what jobs are not? Marketplace's Sally Herships says that.
Temp workers of America, I have some good news, or depending on your ambition, bad news for you. Temp jobs right now, hot. If you want to see the numbers for yourself, they're in the jobs report.
The industry category is employment services, and within that there's a subcategory which is temporary help services. Those are your temp agencies.
Linda Barrington is director of the Institute for Compensation Studies at Cornell. She says 21,000 new temp workers were added last month. Also hot, with 26,000 new workers, accommodations and food services.
Big industry, but adding more in food services and drinking places than in accommodation.
So lots of gigs for bartenders and waitresses. How about, do you want to get a job as a bus driver?
You do not. So transit and ground passenger transportation lost 11,000 jobs.
Equally not hot, jobs in local government. Factory work, lukewarm, but better if you're making things out of metal. Hot, jobs for nurses and other hands-on health workers. But bottom line, providing services is hot. Making things, not as hot. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Traders on Wall Street today reacted exactly the way you'd expect them to. Badly at the open, then worse throughout the day. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There was quite the kerfluffle in front of J.P. Morgan's headquarters on Park Avenue in Manhattan today. News crews were swarming. Passersby were snapping pictures. Police and crowd control barriers, the whole deal. No, not an Occupy Wall Street protest. Facebook was in the building. Executives were in town to meet with some of the bankers that are helping them go public week after next. And J.P. Morgan was decked out like it was hosting a head of state. It even flew a Facebook flag next to the Stars and Stripes. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has the latest about a company IPO like no other.
On the sidewalk outside of J.P. Morgan's headquarters, it was clear the company had Facebook fever. There was the flag, a giant banner, a signature thumbs up like symbol in the window, and so many TV trucks and barricades, executives went in through a side door. J.P. Morgan was handing out Facebook coffee cup holders and baseball hats, and pretty much everyone going in or out of the building was wearing a tie or scarf in Facebook blue.
I think we're looking at a physical manifestation of the amount of excitement with a side order of hype around this Facebook deal.
Max Wolf is chief economist at Greencrest Capital. He says he's never seen this kind of fanfare around a company going public. Wolf says J.P. Morgan and the 32 other banks helping Facebook go public are under enormous pressure to make the stock a success. Facebook and its bankers take to the road next week to drum up interest from investors.
So you're going to see T-shirts and speeches and stories and a media blitz designed to tell the world Facebook is here. You got to be a part of it. And yes, it is worth very close to $100 billion.
This whale of a deal comes at a time when investment banks have been starving for business, says economist Chris Lowe with FTN Financial. He says U.S. investment banks have laid off thousands of workers this year.
There's a tremendous amount at stake. A deal like this is life or death for the investment banking department. It's enough to keep them going for another year.
Banks stand to take in around $100 million in fees from the Facebook IPO, minus the cost of hats. Facebook is expected to start selling shares later this month. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
There's a real tendency to get sidetracked by statistics when you do business and economic news. Leading indicators this and unemployment rate that, which is why talking to actual people as a way to get some perspective is really helpful. Last summer, we found a guy named Don Holshue. He's a truck driver out in the Midwest, and we knew a good thing when we had one, so we stayed in touch, and we called him up again. Mr. Holshue, it's good to talk to you again.
Oh, good to talk to you again. Thanks for calling.
Where did we track you down this time?
I'm in St. Paul, Minnesota.
Pulled over on the side of a highway someplace on I-35 or no?
Well, I'm in the truck yard. I'm about ready to go home.
So how are things?
Not too bad. You know, I mean, it's trodden along.
That doesn't sound not too bad. That sounds more bad than not too bad.
It's food and fuel. You know, I mean, the fuel jumped up quite a bit. You know, it's leveled off right now. But the food is just, you know, going to the grocery store is almost having a heart attack. I have to take my banker along with me.
Well, you know, it's funny because if you talk to central bankers, like guys like Ben Bernanke, you listen to him and he says, yeah, you know, inflation's fine in this country. There's really no inflation, especially if you don't count food and fuel.
Well, that's what most people buy is food and fuel. You know, that's how they term their paycheck. If it doesn't go that far, you know, how many people are going on food stamps? Just trying to get by.
What about people you meet out on the road? You know, the people whose hardware stores you deliver to or people you talk to in the truck stops? I mean, what are they saying?
Well, they just say, you know, I ask them, well, what do you think, how the economy's going? And they just say, it sucks. That's it. You know, I hate to be the guy at the end of the bar, but it just sucks.
You know, it's always so interesting to talk to you because the sense I get from you and the actual economy out there is so disconnected from what you see on Wall Street and what you hear politicians saying about how things are getting better. It's always eye-opening.
Well, it's just normal in my area. I don't know if different regions or type of work it's getting better, but you know, for us, that's like I said, on the ground, or just you know, it's just the same. It's not getting any better, and it's getting a little bit more difficult with the you know the food going up and fuel and you know the people who have to drive to work every day. I feel sorry for them.
You sound almost resigned to this, like it's not ever going to get better.
Well, I know I'm not, you know, going to commit suicide, but you know, I just don't see anything that's happening, you know, something that's hopeful in the future for the economy.
Do you get the sense that people who are in charge of making these kinds of decisions in this country get that?
No, they don't get it. You know, they make a lot of money. They don't see us.
Don Holshue, got him in St. Paul, Minnesota this time.
Yeah, I'll give you the horn.
Makes it all worthwhile, man. Makes it all worthwhile. Have a great day.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Coming up.
So you really start to see water in everything as well as water being abused everywhere. And it's, again, not just our showers, it's not just our appliances, but it's also in all the products that we buy.
For now, it's there anyway. But first, let's do the numbers. Oh, Oh, yeah. The Dow Industrials dropped 168 points today. 1 2/10% ended at 13,038. The NASDAQ lost 67 points, 2 1/4%, 2956. The S&P 500 gave back 22 points, 1.6%, finished at 1369. I told you jobs was a four-letter word, didn't I? For the week, the Dow dropped 1.4%. The NASDAQ off 3.7%. The S&P 500 lost 2 4/10%. Energy stocks didn't really electrify the market today. Chevron shed 2%. Exxon slumped more than 1 1/4%. Solar panel maker First Solar faded 6% today after a less than bright earnings report yesterday. Technology companies also led the charge down. Microsoft off more than 2%. Apple sliced off almost 3% today. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note, look at this one, fell to 1.88%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to freakonomicsradio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve is scheduled to report on consumer credit for March. Ceremonies take place at the Kremlin for the swearing-in of Vladimir Putin as president of Russia. And on May 7th, 1789, a ball was held in New York in honor of the new U.S. president, George Washington. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Should you have an opinion about fracking, the controversial yet increasingly popular process of getting oil and gas out of shale, you've got 60 days from right now to weigh in. That's the comment period for new rules the Obama administration announced today for fracking on public lands. Companies are going to have to disclose the chemicals they pump underground to get the oil and gas out, about which there has been relatively little comment from the industry. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong has that story.
In today's announcement, the Secretary of Interior praised fracking for improving energy security. The chief oil lobby noted constructive changes to the rules. And one of fracking's green enemies deemed it a step in the right direction. Something's in the water. Or maybe it's no big deal. Most companies already disclose the chemicals they shoot underground to get oil and gas. Analyst Raoul LeBlanc is with PFC Energy.
These rules are mostly to deal with corner cutters and laggards. Most of the leading companies, they have severe reputation risk that's already pushed them to do these kinds of things.
By one estimate, 7 in 10 companies disclose. Why? To be or to appear transparent, or because the state they're in requires it. Duke environmental scientist Rob Jackson thinks everyone is on the disclosure road, which could lead to safer fracking.
Full disclosure will put pressure on companies to phase out the more toxic chemicals and to find substitutes for those.
Both the states and the feds let companies frack first and disclose later. Industry lobbied for it. And that one detail rankles Ray Byersdorfer. He's a geologist at Youngstown State University.
I don't really know of any other industries where they're allowed to do something and then sort of tell the regulators afterwards that this has happened.
If there is a big fracking disaster, stiffer rules or bans could follow. So watch Pavilion, Wyoming. The EPA has a preliminary finding there that fracking is likely associated with contaminated drinking water. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
Picking up once again with the early theme of this program, jobs. We talked about interns yesterday, unpaid interns who were suing their bosses. A lot of you wrote to tell us about your days in the intern trenches, including Jennifer Zambecki of Wichita, Kansas.
I had 7 internships between middle school, high school, and college, all unpaid. These experiences were priceless. They showed me what I did not want to do for a living, meaning I didn't waste any post-college years on career paths that sounded like a good fit in theory, but weren't really good for me.
Seth Levy from New York City says, like it or not, putting in your time as an intern is inevitable in this economy.
There are no longer entry-level jobs. There are jobs with entry-level pay. And these jobs all require that you have 1 to 3 years' experience. So if you're starting out in the workforce, it's pretty much impossible to avoid doing an unpaid internship.
Finally, Mother's Day and the recognition thereof. Stephen Dubner was back with us this week discussing the Freakonomics of the second Sunday in May. And even though Dubner corrects me all the time, a lot of you took him to task for saying we shouldn't buy fresh flowers for our moms because most of them are grown overseas and shipped here in a not entirely environmentally friendly way. Deborah Prinzig from Seattle actually started off on Dubner's side.
My first thought was, oh, this is great. Stephen is going to advocate for consumers to support locally grown domestic cut flowers. Instead, my jaw dropped when I listened to him offer the ill-informed suggestion that listeners give their mothers plastic flowers, petroleum-based, and certainly not sustainable. Happy Mother's Day.
Mom, should you happen to be listening, real flowers this year, I promise. Write to us. Send us flowers, whatever you like. Marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Here's a little thought experiment as a way to set up this next story. Think of all the times today that you've used water. H2O, the stuff you drink, the main ingredient in coffee and soda and beer, the thing that comes out of the faucet and the shower head, probably a flush or two as well. So, how many times today? All right, now think about this. How many gallons of water do you think that adds up to? Too many, according to a new documentary film out today, The Last Call at the Oasis. It's directed by Jessica Yu. Jessica, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
This is, it's going to sound like an improper question, but bear with me. Tell me about your showers when you were a kid.
My showers. Okay, so I grew up in Northern California,
yeah.
Had the bucket in the shower to save the water before it turned warm. And my parents also had one of the first early water pick, water saving shower heads. And it really felt like someone was angrily spitting on you.
Right.
Not a pleasant experience.
So your history with water goes way back. I mean, this is not a new thing for you.
No, but I thought somewhat smugly that I was fairly aware of water issues. And I realize now all I really knew was some drought.
Yeah.
If you look at it, it's issues of water quantity, water quality, it's drought, it's politics, it's regulation, it's pollution.
Yeah.
And the hard thing is understanding how it all fits together.
It's been raining here in LA the past couple of days. And when I go out on my morning runs at 5:30, 6 o'clock in the morning, it's raining and wet and has been drizzly for 72 hours, and yet sprinklers are going on all over the neighborhood. It makes me crazy.
I have a physical reaction to seeing that and people hosing down their sidewalks. You really start to see water in everything as well as water being abused everywhere. And it's, again, not just our showers, it's not just our appliances, but it's also embedded in all the products that we buy.
Well, yeah, and you make this great comparison at some point in this movie. You say, you know, the average swimming pool is 18,000 gallons, and yet to make, what is it, 4 pounds of beef, it also takes 18,000 gallons worth of water.
And that's a crazy equivalent. Of course, you look at a swimming pool, right? You're thinking, oh, the swimming pool, that's where the water is. And not so much. I mean, it's just not even on our radar.
I actually took a look at my water bill as I was getting ready to come talk to you. And water's really cheap. It's crazy cheap.
Thank you for bringing that up. Pricing is a great signal for people to recognize usage and to value water.
Right.
And so if you look at Singapore in terms of conservation, they pass on the cost to their consumers. You ask the average Singaporean what his or her water bill is, and they know.
Yeah.
And in this country, again, people have this idea water should be free.
Right.
And Fresno just got water meters a couple of years
ago. No, come on. Seriously?
They didn't even have water meters.
There's a line of thought in the sustainability community and among some economists as well, that at some point in the not very distant future, water is going to be more expensive than crude oil.
Yeah. Well, if you look at bottled water, it already
is, right? Right? Exactly.
There were some revelations in the making of this film that stunned me, that made me think, hey, there's a business as usual ending milestones that are not that far ahead. Take the example of the dropping levels in Lake Mead.
Mm-hmm.
There is a measurable.
Sure. You can see it, right? They have that bathtub ring around there where it's dropped 20, 30, whatever it is, feet. Yeah.
And if it gets down to 1050, you have Hoover Dam stop, will no longer generate electricity.
Oh, is that right?
Well, right. And so we're not too far away from that.
Hmm.
But to keep the levels up in Lake Mead, there have been some releases from water from Lake Powell.
Wow.
I've had this fantasy that if I were king, I would turn off the water for 5 minutes once a week.
Just to see what happens, right?
Just to see what happens.
People.
Right. I think there's almost a failure of imagination. We cannot imagine a time when we won't have water fully available to us.
Jessica Yu, her new film is called Last Call at the Oasis. Thanks a lot for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, which comes to us courtesy of Spirit Airlines. Starting in November, should you need to carry a piece of luggage on board a Spirit flight and neglect to pay in advance of arriving at the gate, that'll be $100, please. A C-note for each bag you carry on board, which pretty much forced us to dig into our archives and pull this out from the Marketplace Players a couple of years ago.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is your captain speaking. We've reached our cruising altitude. Just want to give you a quick rundown of the amenities available for purchase on this flight. In a few minutes, we'll be cutting off the supply of oxygen in the economy cabin. Additional oxygen can be purchased for a nickel per minute. Just slip your coins into the slot in the armrest. Exact change is required. If you need change, our attendants will provide it to you for an additional fee of $1 per nickel. In about an hour, we'll be flying over the Grand Canyon, and you can take a look by inserting a $5 bill in the slot beside your window. The window shade will pop up for exactly 23 seconds. $30 to use the restroom, $10 a flush, and when you get back to your seat, our attendants will be happy to recline it for you for $57. Or for $5, they'll punch you in the head so hard you black out for the whole flight. That's about it. Now just sit back, relax, and enjoy the next 2 hours. At that point, passengers who refuse to pay our $200 completion fee will be thrown off the plane 36,000 feet above Wichita, while the rest of us continue on to New York. Thanks again for traveling with us. We know you have a lot of choices when flying, and they're all bad, so shut up.
Rico Galliano, ladies and gentlemen. The radio show that he does with Brendan Francis Noonan is called The Dinner Party. Check it out. There's a link to the podcast on our website. All right, that's it. We got to go. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow tumbled 168 points on that jobs report, 1.2%. The NASDAQ off 67 points, 2.25%. The S&P 500 gave back 22 points, 1.6%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's acting producer is Megan Larson. The executive producer of the broadcast is Deborah Clark. JJ Yore is the vice president and general manager. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money. Once again, don't take personal finance advice from this man.
My salary went from $5 million to under $1 million. I went through a divorce. And the financial crisis, with those three things happening at one time, it really put me in a unique situation. And trust me, you don't choose this.
I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you back here on Monday. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.